This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, cause someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Left and right. This is a very elementary topic. It's what everyone already knows or should know about politics. It's common sense. Unfortunately, it isn't so common. Left and right are political terms, and politics, generally speaking, is the discussion, the debate, the warfare over state or societal or organizational policies. So politics is the fight over what the policies should be. And it's a subset of life, life as a game. And the most important part of this game of life is that it's up to you to figure out what the object of the game is and what the rules are. And when I call it a game, I'm speaking metaphorically. It's reality, really. It's trying to figure out what this reality that you're born into is all about. Politics is a subset of that. And the interesting thing about this is that nobody can tell you. Nobody will tell you, and nobody really can tell you what these what the object is of life and what the rules are. Or actually, many people will claim that they can tell you, but that they give you these conflicting tales. And it's really up to you to figure it out for yourself, which is right. And much of this you can really only learn indirectly. There aren't any books that will sum it all up for you that you can go and read, or there's really a cacophony, an overabundance of information in that regard. You really can only figure it out by paying attention, close attention, to how things actually work, to what's really going on in reality, more so than what other people say about how things should be or how they think things are. You have to see it and understand it for yourself. Now, when I talk about rules, I'm not talking about laws. Okay, laws are things that are man-made, and they're broken and they're violated all the time. Thou shalt not murder or steal, broken all the time. They're the basis, those kind of principles are the basis for our laws. And people, there are serious consequences. People go to jail, for breaking those laws. I'm not saying that they're not important, but when I talk about rules and what I'm discussing here, what I'm getting at here are really the properties of this reality around us, the properties of nature, things that can't just be violated at will without consequences, without that don't require necessarily police to come around and enforce, that nature itself will enforce the punishment, enforce the penalty. Now, one of these rules that I can identify as amongst the most important is the rule that a group trumps any individual. The power of a group overpowers the power of an individual. And a related rule is that a group also, and this is kind of paradoxical, a group also trumps everybody. And that requires some explaining, I think, in that what I'm getting at there is a focused group that is aware of itself and is pursuing its interests, its narrow interests, will trump a larger group that isn't aware of its interests and instead has a fuzzier, more diverse view as to what it is and what its interests are. You think of, a pack of predators running around in a herd, a larger herd of herbivores, that aren't hunters, that are just scared herd animals, and how those predators can easily take down separate out and take down individuals of that herd, even though the herd may be far larger and often is. And it's has to do with the strategies that are used and the narrowness, the focus of the identity of that group. It's sureness in itself and its common cause. Now, a corollary of these two rules, that the group trumps an individual and the groups trump everybody's, or larger groups, is that really groups are competitive with other groups, and they have to be of comparable heft. As I say, the larger group that's less focused will be trumped by a smaller group that is more focused. And a smaller group, even if it's focused, is going to lose to a larger group that's focused to a comparable degree. Now, the most elementary rules for groups I've talked about before when talking about group identity, and the two that come up right away are, well, who is this group? What identifies this group? What defines us? How do we identify ourselves? How do we recognize ourselves? That kind of rule. And then the second is, once you decide who's in your group, who's a member of your group, is the argument about, well, what's best for our group? What should we do now? Now that we recognize ourselves, where should we go? Who do we need to defeat in order to get what we want? Who's threatening us? And who do we have to defend ourselves from? That kind of stuff. Now, that's, you can see how that's tied to politics, and that politics, this, the fight over what the policies in any given society should be, really is the struggle between different groups. And it's although individuals try to participate and society as a whole tries to participate, that it's really these sort of mid-sized groups that really have the advantage in that situation. Now, these kind of things aren't really what's taught in school. I'm not talking about things that you can go to law school or get a degree in government and learn. They don't teach this way of looking at it in public school, certainly not, and even in private school, where you pay a lot of money to get a good education. You won't learn these kinds of things, and they're generally not even taught by parents who are aware, because most people are simply not really thinking of politics in these terms. Instead, they think in very superficial terms, in terms of like left and right, these polarized terms for it. Now, science, I have some notes here about how science actually comes closest, I think, to determining what the rules are of reality. That's kind of the purpose of science. That's what it's about, is trying to figure out reality. But most of the effort in science goes into figuring out the inhuman rules, the things that don't have to do with human beings so much and are just the properties of nature itself. I'm thinking now of math, physics, chemistry, things like that, inanimate properties of reality is another way to put it. And there have been attempts, though, to try and map this to the social sciences, to try and apply the rigor of the search for the contours of reality or the nature of reality amongst human beings. Anthropology is one of those areas of study. And as I've talked about in previous installments, anthropology was hijacked by the Jews and made safe, you know, that it wasn't about race as it was initially founded and starting to discover the reality of the scientific reality of race. It was just then that the Jews entered into it and turned it all into a cultural thing. And today, cultural anthropology dominates, which is a Jewish-dominated anthropology. But there are still efforts in science. Evolutionary biology is one field where things such as competition between groups, this group evolutionary strategies, are discussed. Now, in these strategies for the struggles between groups and the debate over politics, the fight over politics, it's important to acknowledge the role of cheating and lying and fraud in that struggle. And fraud and such fraud and lying being, you know, the deliberate deception for the gain of your group, regardless of what it costs the other groups, because after all, you're in a struggle with them. And the role of cheating and lying specifically is related to the wearing of disguises by either predators or parasites. And the aspects of this, some of the aspects of this kind of cheating and lying in politics are fooling other groups into believing that there are no other groups. I've talked about that before as everyone is us, the idea that everyone is us, this universalist attitude that white societies, Western societies, seem to be based on, and that it's mainly white people that buy into. Another aspect of cheating and lying is fooling the other team or the other group into accepting enemies onto their team as part of their group. So if you think everybody's us, I mean, these two things are kind of related, that then you can't have an enemy, and so it doesn't really matter. You know, another way that this comes out is in downplaying the seriousness of what's at stake, that it is just a game or that it's just politics and, you know, that it's not really an existential struggle. And so therefore you don't really have to think in terms of like using words like enemies, because after all, they're not enemies. They're just people that maybe have a different opinion. That's really a deception, that idea. And part of that, that's tied up with the idea that discrimination is wrong, that you shouldn't be discriminating against other people, and certainly shouldn't be prejudiced against them based on preconceived conclusions about what they are or what they want, what they're going to do, which is a lie. It's wrong. And probably the most important lie, of course, is that lying itself is wrong. And yet it's essential to the success of all of these different aspects of this kind of strategy, that for a group or a team, a race that uses this kind of strategy, the lying is actually essential. Now, the thing about lying, though, is that lying to a friend is wrong. So the idea that lying is wrong is right in that sense, that if you're talking about your friends or your family, your in-group, then yes, lying is wrong. But lying to an enemy is not wrong. And that really explains why there's so much of it, is because it's people lying to their enemies. And sort of a follow-on to that, a corollary to that, is when somebody lies to you and you catch them in a lie, what you've caught them demonstrating is that they regard you as an enemy. Maybe they don't even think about it consciously in those terms, but that's why they're able to lie to you, is because they don't regard you as someone that they care for enough not to lie to. Now, to get in the meat of these terms, left and right, there's actually a Wikipedia page on left and right politics. And it's based, as many of you probably already know, in the politics of France round about the Revolution, toward the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century. And the Wikipedia page describes it as, in France, where the terms originated, the left has been called, quote, the party of movement, unquote, and the right, the party of order. The intermediate stance is called centrism, and a person with such a position is a moderate. And it strikes me that the synthesis between the left's movement and the right's order equals an orderly movement forward, or at least an orderly movement. But you could think that the only hope for progress, for moving towards some goal, would be to do it. To first of all, to move. I mean, that seems obvious, but to do it in an orderly fashion as well, not to just run chaotically in whatever direction you want to go, because then you won't necessarily get to your goal. But that the division between left and right really isn't about synthesizing those two elements. It's about dividing them. It's about preventing them from becoming united together. It's one of the effects of polarization, the political polarization into left and right, and giving people that perception that they have to be either left or right, is a way of hamstringing and preventing orderly movement, cooperation. So polarization. And I think, as it was at the time in France, it's a white population we're talking about being polarized. Today it's more complicated now that we've got non-whites in our societies and voting alongside us. It's more complicated. But when I'm talking about these terms left and right, and more of what I'll get into here, it's focused on whites. And from an American point of view, of course, because that's what I am, that's what my experience is. Although I'm trying to keep it in general terms here that apply generally. The terms left and right, Wikipedia goes on, appeared during the French Revolution of 1789, when members of the National Assembly divided into supporters of the king to the president's right and supporters of the revolution to his left. So there's order and movement. One deputy explained, "We began to recognize each other. Those who were loyal to religion and the king took up positions on the right of the chair so as to avoid the shouts of the opposing camp." One of the slogans that's well known that came out of the revolution was liberté, égalité, fraternité. I'm probably mangling the French pronunciation there, but it means liberty, equality, and fraternity, or brotherhood. That slogan was one of many, but that was the slogan of the left, and that's what prevailed in the wake of the revolution. The left, in that sense, is focused on equality, and you could see that the right is focused on inequality, at least rhetorically speaking. That's no longer true anymore in contemporary times. Soon after the revolution, though, the motto was actually modified: liberty, equality, fraternity, or death. And that's, in fact, what happened, is it meant death, the French Revolution did, for the aristocracy. It ended up leveling society by death, by murder, by guillotine. And the aristocracy was decimated. Left and right have since evolved into more of a divide and conquer, as I said, a way to keep the two complementary spirits from uniting and keep them instead divided. keep us going nowhere in a very disorganized fashion. And I think that the root of it, really, that it really is native to Europeans, that these two separate spirits that are behind this left and right duality, that it's based on the two separate or at least distinct racial strains amongst Europeans, the old European, which tended to be and have a mentality that was more egalitarian, more communal, more reflective of a common peasantry, I want to say, but you know, basically that we're all equal. That's egalitarianism. And the other strain is the Aryan strain, that invaded into Europe and conquered and eventually melded with the old Europeans. And the Aryan attitude, the Aryan mentality, was more based on hierarchy. And that's where I think the aristocracy comes from, and the instinct for aristocracy. And this is where the conflict comes from. It's you know, in our genes. It's built into us biologically. And since most Europeans are some mixture of old European and Aryan, that there really enough time has gone by now, many tens of generations, that we're blended, and it's still kind of lumpy in certain places in Europe, but we see this mixture even cutting across families, that families have knockdown, drag out fights over this equal and unequal egalitarian versus aristocracy attitudes, things that reduce down to that, and that we identify as left and right. Now, I haven't mentioned the Jews, and not much of this left and right really does, when you see it described in the mainstream, discussed in the mainstream, not much of it does touch on the Jews, but the Jews are there behind it all. I see their role in this, not in creating left and right, but in emphasizing it, in harping on it, in polarizing. They are the agents that are actively causing us to be polarized. They use their media to propagandize it, to promote it, so that people think in these terms and think that these are the only terms to think in. Some other forms of this duality or evidence of it, some other names for it are blue and red, especially in the United States. They call the left blue and the right red. And you'll see that often in blue states versus red states. Liberal and conservative are two terms that are often used. Liberal associated with left, conservative with right. There's certain instincts, I think, underneath this left and right that are identifiable. Already mentioned movement versus order. Similar, you could think, and these are not necessarily good or bad things. I don't mean to take sides here in left versus right. I'm going to try and present what I think are the different poles in that are being polarized when we see this division between left and right. On the one side, the breaking of laws or the violation of taboos and norms versus the making of laws on the right side. On the left, the prioritizing of freedom versus on the right, the prioritizing of duty. On the left, a sort of affinity for novelty and change, and on the right, an affinity more for tradition, stability, predictability, consistency. On the left, a preference for urban living, for cities, and on the right, more of a preference for being in touch with the land, a rural country attitude. On the left, a more secular and even nihilistic tendency, whereas on the right, there's more of a tendency toward a religious belief, spirituality. On the left, a low birth rate. That's just seems to be a fact. And on the right, more of a high birth rate. On the left, a tendency to hope and dream. And on the right, more of a pragmatic and realistic approach. On the left, a more collectivist attitude, a broader concept of who us is, and on the right, a more individualist, a narrower idea about who us is. And this is reflected in the ideological systems that are associated with left and right, specifically on the left, Marxism, and on the right, fascism. And on the left, socialism, and on the right, nationalism. And keep in mind here that this polarization, this idea that we're encouraged to think that of left and right as opposites, and what purpose that serves in keeping, for instance, nationalism and socialism divided from each other. Now, how do left and right actually differ, apparently? They differ on the role of the government, the two sides, the people who identify as left versus right, argue about what role government should play. That's basic to politics and policies. What should the policies of government be? Which policies of what the government should do? The tax rates, abortion is one that in the United States is a strong divider between left and right. And identity politics is a big one. That the left, the Democrats, openly favor non-whites over whites. And talk in explicitly racial terms. And this goes back to what I've said about how the left initially was for equality. And the right, it was the right that was arguing inequality. And today, instead, we have the left, the nominal left, the Democrats are openly in favor. They claim that there is an inequality in favor of whites and that they want to right that by openly favoring non-whites over whites. And on the right, you have amongst the Republicans a dog whistling, a sort of talking in code that tends to empirically attract whites and not non-whites. But it isn't really an explicit acknowledgement of race. In fact, if there's any pretense at equality these days, it's amongst the right. It's amongst the Republicans, the conservatives. Some disappearing differences, things that were differences in the past, are things like attitudes about homosexuality and immigration. Both of those are shifting very quickly so that both parties, really, both sides of this political spectrum are in agreement on those things. I have a few other notes here, but just to move it along, it's the phase that we're entering now. Things are changing and shifting of the way that left and right has been defined and talked about in the past, and we're moving towards what's being described as post-racial. And all it really is that the old methods and terminology aren't really necessary anymore as white consciousness and numbers shrivel. It's not necessary really to lie to whites anymore about the preference for non-whites. And there's an increasing racial divide, and it's becoming increasingly obvious. As I've said, the left affirms race. They acknowledge that race exists and it's significant. They deny that it's biological, but they acknowledge that it's important. And they base their policies on race. It's the right that is now denying race. And even when you examine closely and you see someone like an ideologue like Ann Coulter, who strongly identifies as right and conservative, she even doesn't really avoid race. She talks about race, she talks about the blacks and the browns and favors them over the whites, who she won't talk about. The most significant difference and division in politics is racial. It's not left versus right. The political discourse that's promoted by the Jewish media strongly encourages whites to identify with these social constructs, these left, right, liberal, and conservative, rather than racially. And as white numbers and racial consciousness has declined, the reality is increasing, obviously.